From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This week, Katharine Graham, the former publisher of The Washington Post, won a Pulitzer Prize for her autobiography. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview we recorded last year, just after the book was published. Although she was known as the Iron Lady and is credited with building the Post into one of the great newspapers, Graham was insecure and inexperienced when she inherited the paper from her husband after his suicide in 1963. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews two new books that attest to the discrimination women face on construction crews. And poet laureate Robert Pinsky reads one of his poems and one of his favorite poems by another writer. This month, he launched his favorite poem project. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. 11 people are dead in three states after severe storms swept through the South. The system is still alive and barreling down on the East Coast. Severe weather is predicted from New England all the way down through the Southeast. The storms sparked two tornadoes yesterday that roared through downtown Nashville, Tennessee. 100 people were hurt, but no one was killed. The city's mayor says a lot of people are lucky to be alive. Debris and glass are strewn all over Nashville streets. The weather in Florida is nearly perfect for this afternoon's scheduled launch of the space shuttle Columbia. 7 astronauts are slated for a 16-day science mission dubbed NeuroLab. They'll be in orbit with more than 2,000 small animals. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE has more on the mission from the Kennedy Space Center.
There are about 2,000 lab specimens on board the shuttle, and they range from rats to mice to fish to crickets. And basically, the payload crew, which is 2 full-time astronauts and 2 payload specialists who are scientists, they'll be spending about 16 days studying these animals and subjecting them to tests on how the nervous system reacts to spaceflight.
A failed data processor forced NASA to scrub yesterday's launch attempt. Former Cambodian Khmer Rouge leader Pol Pot is to be cremated tomorrow. He died suddenly Wednesday of a heart attack. There's been anger in Cambodia from people who wanted to see the former dictator put on trial for crimes against humanity. More than 1 million Cambodians died in the 1970s when Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge ruled the country. They wanted to remake the nation into a Marxist agrarian state. People were executed, starved, and worked to death. The Russian Duma, or lower house of parliament, has rejected President Yeltsin's controversial choice for prime minister a second time. From Moscow, NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The Duma voted down the nomination of 35-year-old Sergei Kiryenko by an even wider margin than on the first vote a week ago. Today, the former banker and energy minister received only 115 votes in the 450-seat chamber. Earlier this week, it had appeared that Kiryenko was picking up support. What made the difference today was that Duma members agreed not to hold a secret ballot this time. That meant party members were being watched by their leaders and had to toe the party lines. Yeltsin immediately decided to renominate Kiryenko for a third and final time. If he is rejected on the third vote, parliament will be dissolved and new elections held. The final vote must be held by next Friday. This is shaping up as the most serious political showdown between Yeltsin and lawmakers since their violent confrontation in 1993. Andy Bowers, NPR News, Moscow.
United Nations weapons inspectors in Iraq say they're not making much progress. The UN says monitors have made no progress in the last 6 months, even though more sites have been opened to them. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 7.5 points at 9,084. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, as Wall Street winds down another trading week, investors are wondering whether blue chips will be able to end things on an up note. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The earnings barrage began with a report from giant General Motors, one of the 3 Dow component companies that presented Wall Street with quarterly earnings today. While GM says earnings for the first 3 months of the year fell to $1.6 billion, the automaker says its North American operations did significantly better than the same period just a year ago. Also weighing in with earnings today, heavy equipment maker Caterpillar and fast food giant McDonald's. Both are listed on the Dow 30. Both saw their profits rise during the first 3 months of the year. Also today, the Commerce Department reported the nation's trade gap rose 4.2% in February to just over $12 billion. And the government announced today that output at the nation's factories and utilities was up 0.2% last month. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
California's second-largest telephone company says it made a mistake. GTE has released about 50,000 unlisted phone numbers to telemarketers and other businesses. GTE is scrambling to get the numbers back. The California Public Utilities Commission could fine the company $20,000 for each of the 50,000 unlisted customers whose names were released. Hotel chain Host Marriott is buying 13 luxury hotels from the Blackstone Group. The deal's worth about $1.75 billion. Blackstone will become Host Marriott's largest shareholder, and Host Marriott says it'll reorganize as a real estate investment trust. Again on Wall Street, the Dow's up 7.5 at 9,084. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Katharine Graham won a Pulitzer Prize this week for her autobiography. On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded after the book's publication last year. At a time when newspaper women were pretty much confined to the women's pages, Katharine Graham became the publisher of the Washington Post, and she led the paper through its transformation into a major force in the political life of Washington and the nation. She gave the go-ahead on the publication of the Pentagon Papers and had reporters keep on the Watergate story in spite of White House pressure to get off it. Before she retired in 1993, she was sometimes called the Iron Lady, but her memoir Personal History reveals the insecurities beneath the surface. The Post was a family-owned paper. Graham unexpectedly inherited the position of publisher when her husband, Philip Graham, committed suicide in 1963. He had taken the paper over from Katharine Graham's father when he retired. Her father had made his fortune on Wall Street. He purchased the Post in 1933 when Katharine Graham was in high school. I asked what her reaction was.
I was very excited. I'd had a previous interest in journalism. I had even gone on the school paper before he bought the Post. And it whetted my interest, obviously. And I was excited. Of course, it wasn't like it is today. It was one of five newspapers. It was fifth in a field of five, and it had a circulation of 50,000. And it was in a really run-down old building on Pennsylvania Avenue. And so although it was thrilling, it wasn't like it would be today.
In 1940, you got married to Philip Graham, who you describe in your memoirs having a beautiful mix of intellectual, physical, and social charm, and that he was warm and funny on top of that. When your husband was 30, your father made him the associate publisher of the Post, and your husband virtually became your father's deputy. How did you feel about your husband going into journalism and going into the family business?
I was thrilled and loved it. I loved Washington. I loved the paper. we had discussed when he went in the Army, my father said, "Are you interested?" Because he was having a terrible struggle making the paper pay, making it viable. And he said, "I don't want to go through this unless there's some future for the paper. Are you interested?" And my brother was a psychiatrist, and nobody thought of women's ever managing anything. And I said, "It's up to you. I don't want to try to influence you because it's you who are going to have to do it, and it's your life." He had planned to go into law and politics in Florida, where he came from. And so he thought about it a long time, and we talked about it a long time. And finally he agreed that after the war was over, he would come write on the paper. And that's what he did. I loved it.
Now, in 1948, when you were 31, your father decided to pass the paper on to you and your husband. But he gave your husband, I think, nearly three times more shares than he gave you. How did you feel about that inequity? After all, you were the direct descendant of the Washington Post family.
I had no reservations about it. My father said, "I'm doing this because I think no man should work for his wife." Obviously a sexist view of things, but not unusual in those days. And I had no problem with it. I thought it was okay.
Now, you describe your husband as using the Washington Post to right wrongs that you now think is inappropriate for journalism. Give us an example of how he used the paper to change things as opposed to just reporting on what happened.
The first thing he tried to change was the city itself. He redeveloped he was very instrumental in the redevelopment of Southwest Washington, and he certainly had it covered by reporters more than normally would have been. More importantly and more negatively for the paper, he got involved with future president, then majority leader Lyndon Johnson, and he was enamored with Johnson, and he really used the paper to support Johnson. Most importantly, for instance, during the civil rights battle, we were for home rule and civil rights and all that sort of thing. He influenced the coverage of a riot that occurred about opening a swimming pool. And Ben Bradley had covered it, and he was indignant. And my husband said, "Buster, come on up and come to my office. I want you to see what's going on." And in his office, he had Oscar Chapman, then Secretary of the Interior, and he had Clark Clifford, who was then in the White House. And he had a lot of people. And he made a deal with them. If the Post downplayed that story, they would open the swimming pools next year. Now, that was a positive act, but it was involving the paper in an active way that really shouldn't be done. I mean, you should report what is going on instead of using it to deal with the government.
What was at issue here, I think, was that the swimming pool was segregated and your husband wanted it to be integrated.
Of course, right.
And
which was a worthwhile goal, mm-hmm. but which he really committed the error of downplaying the news in order to make the deal about their opening the swimming pool next for the following summer.
You write that as your husband got more power in Washington, he also developed a drinking problem and the symptoms of manic depression. As for yourself, you write, "Despite my pleasure in the life I was leading during those years, I can see now that I was having problems I didn't acknowledge to myself. I was growing shyer and less confident as I got older. I still didn't know how to look my best or how to handle myself in social situations. I was afraid of being boring and went on believing that people related to us entirely because of my husband. As for him, at the same time that he was building me up, he was tearing me down. As he emerged on the journalistic and political scenes, I increasingly saw my role as the tail to his kite. And the more I felt overshadowed, the more it became a reality." When did you realize this, the sense that you were becoming more insecure and more overshadowed by your husband?
I only realized that in retrospect. Two or three close friends, when I went to them at the time that he left the house and went off with a young woman from Newsweek, said to me, "Good." And I said, "Good? How can you say that? It's just devastating. It's awful." And they said, "Don't you realize what he's doing to you, that you're the butt of the family jokes?" And I said, "No, I don't think that's right, and I really am distraught." So it shook me up that they viewed it that way, but I realized really many years afterwards that probably that was right.
What was happening in your life that made you feel increasingly insecure and insubordinate?
I was intimidated by him to the point where I didn't talk when we went out. I just let him talk. And sometimes if I did talk, or he would look at me as if I were going on too long. And it was that kind of thing that really made me think, gee, I must be boring. And I guess led to my silence.
You write that as your husband's behavior grew more erratic with his manic depression and he had an affair, he left you and then decided to buy back your stock within the Washington Post and take over the paper with his new lover. And in spite of your lack of confidence, you decided you were going to fight to hold on to the paper. How did you decide, given your insecurity at that time, to fight to hold on to it?
Because I first didn't, you know, I knew he was ill, and when he left, I thought, oh, well, he's ill. And finally, I realized that this was real, and he was going to lawyers, and he wanted a divorce, and that he was going to take the paper with him. And I thought, well, I can't help what he's doing, but I can fight for to keep the paper, and I'm going to. I mean, if he wanted a divorce, I was going to go into court. And the reason I think I thought I could do this was I knew that the paper had been built up with my father. I knew my father had supported Phil. I knew that I had, in my own way, supported Phil. And I thought he was great and that he had added greatly to the paper. But I had participated in the build-up through my father's earliest years and struggles, and year after year, discouragement because they kept losing money. And all that made me emotional about the paper. I loved the paper, and I just wasn't going to give up. I didn't think particularly how I would do it. I just was going to dig in.
What did your family think? Did they think that you should hold on to the paper because after all, you were the blood member of the family? Or did they feel that, well, you were the woman and even if you were divorcing, it would be better off in the man's hands?
No. Nobody thought that. My father had already died when this happened, but my mother was alive and supported me absolutely and said, you know, we've got to hold on to the paper. And so did all my friends and associates.
Then your husband came back to you, but one day after saying he was going to lie down, he went to the bedroom and shot himself. You heard the gun go off and found him dead. Did you ever think he would go that far, that his manic depression had gotten that severe?
No, and he was very deceptive. He told us all that he was feeling better, and he seemed to be feeling better. He'd been in a mental hospital and had gotten the day off. And I was deceived, and the hospital was deceived into thinking he was better than he was. And as I hear is mostly the case, he had talked a lot about suicide when he was ill, but never done it. And he wasn't talking about suicide at the time that he clearly had it on his mind. I think that happens.
Did he talk about suicide with you or just with other people?
He did with me earlier in the years when he was depressed.
My guest is Catherine Graham, former publisher of The Washington Post. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Catherine Graham won a Pulitzer Prize this week for her autobiography, Personal History. On this archive edition, we're listening to an interview recorded with her last year.
After your husband's suicide, you were, as you write, pushed into a new and unknown life. What did you initially think you were going to do?
I thought I was going to work because I now owned the controlling shares of the company in the paper. And I thought I therefore had the responsibility to learn what made it happen and what made it tick, and that I would go to work solely to learn. That's the way I viewed it.
As opposed to actually take control.
Yes, I thought that there was a man who was chairman of the board, Fritz Beebe, and my husband had brought him on just about a year or two before he died. And he was wonderful, and he wanted me to go to work. And there were a lot of men running the divisions and the editors. And I thought, fine, this will just go on the way it is, and I can learn.
One of your colleagues, a man, said to you, "You're not going to work, are you? You mustn't. You're young and attractive, and you'll get remarried." Did you think, well, maybe that's what I should be doing? I should, you know, just get remarried, start a new family life at home?
That was said by a friend, not a colleague, Chip Bolin, who was in the Foreign Service then and was a distinguished diplomat. And I saw him abroad just before I came home and went to work, and that's what he said. And I said, of course I'm going to work. And it didn't occur to me, in fact, that there was any conflict with getting married if I wanted to. I didn't really think. But in fact, it was so totally demanding that I probably couldn't have gotten remarried, but I didn't think about it.
You write that early on, after taking over the post, you were encumbered by a deep feeling of uncertainty and inferiority and a need to be to please and to be liked. You say, I was unable to make a decision that might displease those around me. How did that affect your decision-making early on and your interactions with the staff?
Oh, it got in my way a lot, but it's a very lot of, it tends to be female baggage, and it still is to some extent. But it was much worse then. The way it affected my performance is that I couldn't say, I've listened to everybody, and now I think we ought to do this. I had to get everybody to agree to whatever it was. And if everybody didn't agree, I'd go around begging them to see my point of view. And it was just a very poor way to be a leader.
Suddenly, your social circle expanded, but that circle was really pretty similar to the one you'd had before with your husband. But now, instead of being the wife, you were the publisher in that circle. How did that change your behavior in that circle? And was there an uncomfortable transition?
I think it was very gradual, because I was used to the people I was relating to, but my profile obviously grew with experience and with time in the job, and I suppose it rose considerably for a bizarre reason, which is that Truman Capote in 1966 gave the black and white ball in my honor. And so suddenly this was written about, and it was a big event, and it was covered. And it was really the beginning of my knowing those people who were at the ball. I didn't know them before that, and they certainly didn't know me.
What was the difference between how you acted within this larger social circle when you were seeing yourself as, like, the wife of the publisher of the Post, compared to how you handled yourself when you became the publisher yourself?
It's hard to really think back to that. I just gradually grew used to it, and I realized that I was going to be conspicuous because I had the job I had. At one point, I was at my friend Joe Alsop's for dinner, and I had been used to the women and the men parting company after Washington dinners. While the men talked about issues and the women went and powdered their nose and discussed their households. And at one point, I suddenly realized that I'd been working all day, that I'd been involved in an editorial lunch with somebody who was in the news, and that I'd been working, and that now I was being asked to go in the other room with the wives. And I said to Joe, who was a good friend, I hope you won't mind if I slip out of here because the paper comes, and I really can use the time better than going in that room with the wives. And he said, oh, darling, you can't do that. And I said, sure I can. I mean, it's just, I don't want to use my time like that, Joe. And so he was so upset that he made me stay, and he broke up the segregation. And then it broke up all over Washington. So that was an instance where I guess suddenly I realized that I was in the working world and that I didn't have to do those things.
When you took over the Post, there were few women in journalism and far fewer women in the kind of upper position that you held. You said that early on you didn't realize that part of what you were experiencing was emblematic of the larger issues in the women's movement. What made you realize that your life really connected to the issues of the women's movement?
Two things. One is simply experience in the workplace and being talked to by women and issues coming up, such as really little issues, but they were symbolic. There's a big newspaper dinner, and no women had ever been invited, called the Gridiron in Washington. And I was invited as a guest. And the women rose up in the paper and wrote me and said, please don't go until there's a woman member. And At first I was startled and said, you know, I was rather thrilled to go, and after all it was a gesture toward opening up. And they said, no, you know, until as a member, don't please go. And we feel very strongly about this. And so I didn't. And of course, it made me aware of those issues. But the other thing that was as important, if not more so, was the rise of the women's movement. In particular, I became a friend of Gloria Steinem, and she argued with me about women's positions and how I should understand them. And at first I said, oh, Gloria, you know, that's not for me. And she said, yes, it is. If you understand what this is about, it will make your life better, and it will make other people's lives better around you. And she was right. So those two things, experience and Gloria.
Okay, so when you realized that Steinem was right and you more personally and intellectually connected to the women's movement, how did that change you personally and change the way you managed the post?
I think it made you certainly more aware of women's problems in the workplace and of the need to get more women in the workplace. It made me more aware of bias in the news, such as somebody being described as a 58-year-old gray-haired grandmother. And I realized that I had to do something and try to make things better in the company. I didn't always succeed because I didn't quite know how to go about it in some cases. I didn't know how to lean on people who were doing a wonderful job but who were blatant male chauvinists and make them understand the issues. But little by little, we made progress, and some of it was due to being sued.
The Post was sued?
Newsweek was sued, the stations were sued,
mm-hmm.
and the Post.
Catherine Graham, recorded last winter after the publication of her autobiography, Personal History. This week, she won a Pulitzer Prize for the book. We'll hear more of our interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Catherine Graham. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two new books about women construction workers by Susan Eisenberg, who's a master electrician, and poet laureate Robert Pinsky reads a favorite poem.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Katharine Graham, recorded last year after the publication of her autobiography. This week, she won a Pulitzer Prize for the book. Graham was the publisher of the Washington Post from 1963 to 93. Her father bought the paper when she was in high school. When he retired, her husband became the publisher. After her husband's suicide in 1963, she took over the paper, but she says she felt unprepared for the responsibility after having lived for so long in her husband's shadow. On top of that, she had to assert her authority at a time when few women were in positions of authority. But it took a while for her to connect to the larger issues of the women's movement and to realize that women at the Post weren't getting a fair shake.
Did you ever confront a man about his chauvinism on the job?
Yes. I wrote a note once that I found in the files in which somebody, a personnel director, had circulated a memo. And he had referred to the men as Brown, Smith, and Jones. And it was, the women were Mary, Sue, and Margaret. And I said, wait a minute here. Why are we referred to by our first name and the other guys are last names? Another instance in which the issue arose was that I recommended a woman to be back of the book editor at Newsweek. And the editors just said, that's impossible. We can't do that. And I must say, I mean, we work long hours. We work weekends. We're here at night. And I stupidly accepted this. And then finally, we were sued by the women at Newsweek. And the editor and Frederick Beebe called me up, and I was on vacation, and said, the women are suing us, and this is very serious. And I said, whose side am I supposed to be on? And Fritz Beebe, my colleague, whom I really loved and respected, said, this isn't funny. And I said, I know it isn't funny, and I'm serious. And on the other hand, as a manager, it bothered me, and I got offended by these suits, but they were right.
The suits were right.
The suits were right, and we did make a lot of progress everywhere as a result, and also as a result of people understanding.
One of the defining moments in your career in journalism and in the life of the Washington Post is when you and Ben Bradley decided to publish the Pentagon Papers, the secret history of the war in Vietnam. And Ben Bradley was saying, publish it and publish it quickly. But your lawyers were saying, wait, don't publish it so quickly. In fact, maybe you shouldn't publish it at all. So either take your time or don't do it, but don't rush into it. How did you make up your mind, being in between your lawyers and Bradley and knowing that this was going to be a really important decision?
It was, I had to do it very quickly, in about a minute, because the editors and the head of the company, Fritz Beebe, were at Ben's house, and they were writing, trying to keep it secret. And the lawyers were there, and they were saying it was very dangerous, and indeed we shouldn't publish, because the Times had been enjoined already from publishing by the government who had taken them to court. And we were in the process of going public. We had announced our plans and not sold the stock, so we were particularly liable to any kind of criminal prosecution from the government. So finally, they called me up because it got so late and the argument got so tense and said, you're going to have to decide this. And I said, well, why do we have to do it right away? The Times took 3 months. And the editors all got on the phone and the business people were on the other phone saying, wait a day. The editors were saying, we mustn't wait a day. Everybody knows we have these papers. And we have to maintain the momentum that was stopped when the Times was enjoined. And it's very important. People have their eyes on us. And we have to publish. And so I listened to them. And finally, after talking to both sides, I asked my colleague Fritz Beebe what he would do when he was a lawyer. And he said, I guess I would not. And that made it hard but not impossible. He said it in such a way that I thought, he's leaving it up to me, and I can do this. And so I said, let's go, let's publish. And I hung up because I was so freaked out by having had to make that decision so fast.
Did you have to decide at that moment what your guiding principles were, whether your guiding principles had more to do with journalism or with just protecting the profits of the company?
You know, I made speeches at the time, and I made them for rather another reason, which is that my image on Wall Street was that when we went public, which was later in 1971, I was this kind of nutty woman who was taking these risks with the company. And I started talking about excellence and profitability go hand in hand. And I really did it to show Wall Street that I cared about profitability because they thought I didn't. But in fact, I think it's true. And I really believed it, that if you invested in the editorial product and built up the production and business side, that it would work. And to a large extent, it did and has.
You built up a lot of animosity from the White House toward the Washington Post through publishing the Pentagon Papers and then breaking the Watergate story. And you say in the book, bearing the full brunt of presidential wrath is always disturbing. Now, you have told us about how insecure you were, the kind of low self-esteem you had as a professional when you took over the Post. And here you are now being criticized by the White House. Did you feel personally able to deal with that kind of criticism?
It was pretty scary, and you had to deal with it. Some people have referred to that as courageous, and I didn't view it as courageous. I viewed it as we had no choice. I think courage is when you have a choice and you choose to be courageous. I thought we had no choice once we got in the Watergate reporting. In the Pentagon Papers, that's true, we did have a choice for about a minute. In Watergate, it was like wading into a river. By the time you realized how serious it was, which was several months into the story, we were into it up to our waists, and there was no way you could go back. You had to go forward. And so I simply had to live with it. I was very anxious. I lay about a foot above the bed, worrying at night. But I also didn't think we had any choice except to proceed and to back the editors and reporters in whom I believed.
Were you worried that one day you'd find out that you were being misled, that you were set up, you were the victim of some kind of scam?
Indeed, I was. I used to go down and talk to Ben and Howard Simons, the managing editor, all the time and ask, are we being fair? Are we being accurate? And are we being set up or misled so that our heads can be chopped off? And they had good answers to these, and they were really reassuring. I don't think they were as assured themselves as inwardly as they seemed to be to me. But they said that some of our sources were Republican, and that because we had the story to ourselves, that Woodward and Bernstein had time to check, and that they often withdrew a story by themselves unless they were... And they had two sources for everything. And thirdly, that Woodward had a source, particular source, to whom he went when he was really bothered and puzzled, and that this source had never misled him. And, of course, the source was later christened by the managing editor, Howard Simons, Deep Throat. I still don't know who Deep Throat was. I didn't know then, and I don't know now.
Are you glad you don't know so other people can't try to get it out of you?
Well, I said to Woodward at one point we met over lunch, and I turned to him and said, who is Deep Throat? And he looked pale and flinched, and I said, oh, it's all right. I don't want the responsibility. You don't have to tell me. He says that he would have told me if I'd asked for it, but I didn't ask for it, and I still don't.
Someday maybe you will, though?
No, not now. Too late.
Too late.
Been there, done that.
You're turning 80 this year.
Yes.
And in your memoir, you write that turning 70 was actually very difficult.
It's true. I think certain birthdays bother you more than others. 50 didn't bother me much. 60 did. 70 did. 80 doesn't.
Why doesn't 80? 70 did, but 80 doesn't.
I think that at 70, I thought, oh, gee, I guess I'm an old woman. And I've come to terms with that. You know, when we're young, you never think you're going to be old. And you sort of, in my day, you saw people with white hair and buns on their head and little old ladies. And I thought, I'm never going to be like that. I mean, I didn't even think about it. I just thought you were young forever. And so to realize that I'd turned 70, I really wanted not to broadcast it. And I went on a trip with some friends out to the West Coast to avoid any observation of it. But my daughter and my children said, well, we want to give a party. And I said, oh, all right, if it's a little party. And, you know, I don't want a lot of people. I don't want people to know I'm 70. And they got the bit in their teeth, and they gave a small party for 600 people, which was widely covered. So this was not a secret from the world.
You've just completed your memoirs, and I'd like to know what surprises you most about your life and who you became.
Well, looking back on it was really interesting, and I liked it. I think this thing that surprised me the most was the role my father played in my growing up. He was very shy and reticent and not very articulate. So I didn't realize until I reread his letters and mine to him how loving and supportive and important he was to my life. I think that's the biggest discovery I made. And I really, really was moved by this.
Catherine Graham, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I thank you. I had a wonderful time, and I appreciate your letting me be here. Thank you very much.
Catherine Graham is the former publisher of The Washington Post. This week she won a Pulitzer Prize for her autobiography, Personal History. Our interview was recorded last year after the book was published. Coming up, two books about women construction workers by a woman who's a master electrician. This is Fresh Air. In 1978, Susan Eisenberg was among the first six women who entered the apprenticeship training program of Boston's Local 103 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. She's now a master electrician, as well as a poet and writer. In two new books, a volume of poetry called Pioneering, and an oral history called We'll Call You If We Need You, she gives readers a view into the embattled world of women construction workers. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Susan Eisenberg's new volume of poems about the dangers, hostilities, and occasional rewards she and other women have experienced working construction is called Pioneering. That sounds like a celebratory title until you read Eisenberg's introduction and learn that federal affirmative action guidelines opened the way for women to enter the construction trades in 1978. Since then, women electricians, carpenters, iron workers, painters, and plumbers have been stuck in the pioneering phase, never rising much beyond 2% of the total construction workforce. As Eisenberg's biting poems attest, it's not been for want of trying. Here's part of one entitled Partner Number 5, in which she describes the tactile feel of construction work as well as the misogyny hovering over the job site. A vault full of 8-foot fluorescents to hang, they stand in separate lifts, movements synchronized, hoist each fixture, drill, and bolt overhead. How much easier it might be if he spoke to her. As she squeezes fingers through a tiny opening to grab wires, she teases about the convenience of small hands. I can do anything in this business, he snarls, and again, silence. The 30 tradeswomen who Eisenberg interviewed for her other book, an oral history called We'll Call You If We Need You, sometimes sound like poets too, like apprentice Hart Crane's or Walt Whitman's, when they're describing the joy of making something lasting and awesome with their hands. Construction worker Lorraine Bertoza, who worked on a skyscraper for 3 years, tells Eisenberg, "When I worked at the top, I was doing parapet walls on the edge of the building. We were hanging off the side on guy lines and safety belts. It was our own world. When you get a pause, you just take in the magnitude of where you are. You can see forever, you know, 45 stories up. It's something most people don't get to do. But as Eisenberg's interviewees also disclose, those moments of transcendence have been dearly paid for by years of muscle aches, pain in the neck harassment, and sometimes life-threatening sabotage. Eisenberg arranges her interviews thematically so that together they compose a frustrating coming-of-age narrative about women still struggling to secure their place in the construction trades. In the early chapters of Eisenberg's book, this first generation of tradeswomen talks about being attracted to construction work for the same reasons as their male counterparts, the promise of good wages and work that wouldn't confine them to an office. Just as predictable are the pornographic pinups and dirty jokes that greeted them once they made it to the job site. The strength of "We'll call you if we need you," however, is the nuanced composite picture it assembles of tradeswomen's experiences. On her second day at the construction site, carpenter Kathy Walsh was pushed down a 40-foot embankment by a co-worker, while all but one of the rest of the men watched. Some other women lucked out and had supportive foremen, good partners, and unions that backed them up. We hear about women losing fingers and hands because no one taught them how to use their tools properly. We also hear about deliberate accidents designed to make their female victims look incompetent. Like most work stories, these also contain grim humor. Bridge painter Deb Williams almost killed her partner by refusing to crawl over his body and hook him to a girder. She thought she was being sexually harassed. Meanwhile, he was being blown off the bridge. Eisenberg just doesn't throw up her hands at the end of "We'll call you if we need you" and leave women construction workers' fates up to individual acts of benevolence. She makes a persuasive case for beefing up affirmative action guidelines and revising archaic union apprenticeship programs that were designed with 18-year-old men in mind. Given the stories she's collected here, it sounds like a few sledgehammer blows to some well-chosen heads wouldn't hurt either.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed two books by Susan Eisenberg, Pioneering, Poems from the Construction Site, and We'll Call You If We Need You, Experiences of Women Working Construction. Coming up, poet laureate Robert Pinsky reads a favorite poem. This is Fresh Air. On the first day of this National Poetry Month, poet laureate Robert Pinsky launched his favorite poem project. His goal is to create an audio and video archive of people from all walks of life reading aloud their favorite poems. We broadcast an excerpt of the kickoff event last week. As part of our National Poetry Month festivities, we're going to feature poet laureate Robert Pinsky reading one of his favorite poems and one of his own poems. His latest collection of poems is called The Figured Wheel. A few years ago, he was on the bestseller list for his translation of Dante's Inferno. When we spoke last September, Pinsky brought a favorite poem by Robert Frost. I asked Pinsky why it's a favorite.
I think it just sounds ravishing. It's like your favorite Coltrane record or your favorite Schnabel performance. I think it just sounds great as a poem. And I guess I also like the way it's about, I'm not in my first blush of youth. I like the way the poem is about a sensibility that both changes over a long time and in other ways stays the same.
You want to read it?
To Earthward. Love at the lips was touch as sweet as I could bear, And once that seemed too much, I lived on air that crossed me from sweet things, the flow of, was it musk from hidden grapevine springs downhill at dusk? I had the swirl and ache from sprays of honeysuckle that when they're gathered shake dew on the knuckle. I craved strong sweets, but those seemed strong when I was young. The petal of the rose it was that stung. Now, no joy but lacks salt that is not dashed with pain and weariness and fault. I crave the stain of tears, the aftermark of almost too much love, the sweet of bitter bark and burning clove. When stiff and sore and scarred, I take away my hand from leaning on it hard in grass and sand. The hurt is not enough. I long for weight and strength to feel the earth as rough to all my length.
That's really wonderful. Now, that's got a rhyme scheme to it. Talk to me a little bit about reading that poem so that the rhyme doesn't become sing-song, so that the rhyme sounds but isn't made too much of.
When the grammar keeps going at the end of a line, your voice should keep going. When the grammar stops at the end of the line, then your voice stops.
Maybe you can give an
example. Let's take an example.
Yeah, good. There we go.
If I say, I had the swirl and ache from sprays of honeysuckle that when they're gathered shake dew on the knuckle, nobody misses the rhymes. You hear it, and I had the swirl and ache from sprays of honeysuckle that when they're gathered shake dew on the knuckle. And part of the pleasure is hearing that sentence snake through the rhymes and reach to where it's going. If you say, I had the swirl and ache from sprays of honeysuckle that when they're gathered, shake, do on the knuckle. That's what killed poetry.
Yeah.
that's not that killed rhyme. You know.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it's probably the most important advice I could give anybody about poetry is when the sentence keeps going, your voice should keep going.
Now you had to do a lot of intricate rhyming yourself when you translated Dante's Inferno, and that actually became a bestseller in 1994, I think shocking everybody. But there's a very intricate rhyme scheme that you had to maintain there. What was the rhyme scheme?
It's called terza rima, and Dante invented it for the Commedia. It didn't even exist before. And it's these three-line stanzas where the outside two, the first and third lines, rhyme. And then the middle line tells you what the outside rhyme is going to be for the next stanza. And it's good for a narrative, as he was writing, because everything is kind of linked, but it can still sound quite musical and even kind of clinching like couplets.
Would you recite a passage from your translation?
Okay. From memory. Day was departing, and the darkening air called all Earth's creatures to their evening quiet, while I alone was preparing as though for war to struggle with my journey and with the spirit of pity which flawless memory will redraw. O muses, O genius of art, O memory whose merit has inscribed inwardly those things I saw, help me fulfill the perfection of your nature.
Like that. let me ask you, when you're dealing with rhyme, how much are you willing to deal with something more like harmony rather than rhyme exactly?
That's it. That's what you do. As I say, thinking about end rhyme isn't the only thing. There's a wonderful sentence in Frost's unrhymed poem, An Old Man's Winter Night, where he says, "A light it was to no one but himself where now he sat, a quiet light. And then not even that." Well, those T's go off beautifully. A light he was to no one but himself, where now he sat, concerned with he knew what, a quiet light, and then not even that. And it's not in rhyme, they're not end rhymes. The what and the at and the quiet and the light.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A light he was to no one but himself, where now he sat, concerned with he knew what, a quiet light, and then not even that. Is that rhyme? I don't know. It's a degree of likeness that's very taking in the poem.
While we're talking about rhyme, I want you to read a short poem of yours that has rhymes within, and it's called An Old Man. Can you talk with us before reading it about why you wanted this to rhyme.
Well, it's only sort of by me. It's based on my reading of translations of Constantine Cavafy's poem, An Old Man, a poem I loved in translation for many years, and I knew from reading the notes in the Sheridan Keeley and in the Ray Dalvin translations that it was in a very complicated rhyme scheme. And one day I got the notion I could do it. I call it An Old Man after Cavafy, and it's pretty close to what Cavafy wrote, but I can't read Greek. It's, you know, it's my poem based on the translations. I don't know whether to call it a translation or a poem. An Old Man after Cavafy. Back in a corner, alone in the clatter and babble, an old man sits with his head bent over a table and his newspaper in front of him in the cafe. Sour with old age, he ponders a dreary truth. How little he enjoyed the years when he had youth, good looks and strength and clever things to say. He knows he's quite old now. He feels it. He sees it. And yet the time when he was young seems, was it yesterday? How quickly it slipped away. Now he sees how discretion has betrayed him and how stupidly he let the liar persuade him with phrases. Tomorrow, there's plenty of time. Someday. He recalls the pull of impulses he suppressed, the joy he sacrificed. Every chance he lost ridicules his brainless prudence a different way. But all these thoughts and memories have made the old man dizzy. He falls asleep, his head resting on the table in the noisy cafe.
Poet laureate Robert Pinsky reading An Old Man. His latest collection of poems is called The Figured Wheel. Our interview was recorded last September. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shirok. Our engineers this week are Chris Fraley, Audrey Bentham, Fred Snyder, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan, too, directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.